Well, hello and welcome to the Australian Law Student Podcast. I'm Alex Nilsson, and today we have a very special episode with a very special guest. Our first ever time having a guest, and let me tell you, we've done well for our first one. I'll give you a hint as to who he is. He's a commercial and litigation lawyer who approaches his work with a combination of approachability and rigor. Now, that's his day job. You probably know him from his Coffee in a Case Note podcast, or maybe perhaps his Spooko podcast, depending what you're into. This focuses on horror movies. And he releases one a week, so very interesting stuff. Recently, he has become the owner and founder of his very own law firm, Graviman, which will practice in some interesting niches of commercial law, which we'll be able to get into soon. But for now, good morning to Mr. James Dapici.
Thank you so, so much for having me, Alex. As we said off mic, well, may we say good morning. It's a slightly rusty one for me in Australia. Had some good sporting success last night that I managed to enjoy all of. And so feeling the after effects this morning.
Well, we're not a cricket podcast, but we are an Australian podcast. So I think it's fair to discuss that, yes, we've had a good win overnight, maybe one that we weren't expecting a couple of weeks ago. Yes. Big night for you, James. I caught it. I pulled up stumps early, but you didn't.
You've got the lingo, yes.
No pun intended there. So just firstly, James, before we get into the nitty-gritty of your background in terms of what you do as a commercial litigation lawyer, just wanted to quickly mention as a part of our legal news segment, the recent High Court decision in, it's a pseudonym NZYQ, which has overturned indefinite detention of unlawful non-citizens. And it was ruled incompatible with the constitutional limits, which has been held up by Al-Khateb and Godwin in 2005. So this decision has overturned about 20-odd years of precedent. 20-plus years of precedent. So obviously, James, we don't have the judgment yet, so we can't get into the nitty-gritty of it. But I feel that this is a fair progression in the law and maybe shows the direction that the High Court will be heading in the Gageler era. Any thoughts on that, James, or you happy to agree with what I said?
It's probably not for me to add as it's out of area, but I do think marinating on judgments that sort of affect an entire, and I'll loosely use the commercial word sector, like this, can sort of aid us as we sort of get oriented. You know, the cases we remember from uni, our Al-Khatebs, our snails in a bottle, our carbolic smoke balls. It's always instructive to sort of have the what we might think of as academic understanding of the law as it was sort of brought to the fore in contemporary decisions. So it's a decision that'll have to be read properly for either of us to make a proper comment, as you rightly say.
Yeah.
But it does strike me as one that does give some pretty clear suggestions as to where that sector will be heading, and I will make no comment on it as I try to avoid commenting on judgments as best I can, Alex. But we have an outcome, and we'll have a judgment soon.
I feel, as a law student, I feel a bit cheated that I've just wrapped my head around Al-Khateb and now it's all been thrown out the window. But that's for another
welcome
episode.
To legal practice.
So, James, tell me, there's 24 hours in a day. You are a commercial litigation lawyer. You run your Coffee in a Case Note podcast, which is presented weekly, very regularly. You have your Spooko podcast, which is also weekly. You've just started your own law firm, Graviman. You're the founder. Can you explain to me where you find, and mind you, you also have a family life. You find time to watch the cricket. So tell me how you manage this. This is a lot of time and not a lot of, a lot of work and not a lot of time, James. How do you manage this?
Yes. Would you like the honest answer, Alex? The honest answer is similar to anyone who does a lot of things is I probably sleep less than I ought to.
Right.
And that's not always cricket related. In fact, it's very, very rarely cricket related.
That's why the coffee's
and
important.
So, yes, exactly so. I have a number of goals that include sleeping a bit more and these sorts of things into the future. But if I can sort of get to the real meat of the question about time management, over the years it's just become a real question of priorities for me. Spooko, the horror film podcast, and I should say I'm too scared to watch horror films, so that podcast is all about my co-host sharing the scary plots so that I can freak out. that is really efficiently run, and all I do is show up for a chat for about half an hour, 40 minutes,
yeah,
and off I go. So all the editing and all the actual hard work, heavy lifting, is handled by handled by my co-host, who's also my best mate from high school.
Oh, nice.
And so that serves as a significant proportion of my social life. And then with work stuff, and I sort of put coffee and a case note sort of within the kind of work parameters, within that sort of umbrella. A big part of coming up as a young lawyer is sort of learning timesheets and learning time management, mm. and how much time in the day should be billable, and how much time in the day should be business development and marketing, and how much time of the day should be admin. And I'm afraid just over the years, those experiences have compounded that sort of allow me to think about time in a fairly regimented way, which is fairly beneficial for doing legal work. Yeah. There's an argument that it's not as beneficial for other facets of life, where I might have fairly inflexible ways of thinking about some things. But the real answer on the time management thing for me over the years has just become a question of prioritizing and what is important to me. So, you know, family one, daylight two, and then if I have sort of professional ambitions or, you know, creativity ambitions, we can then think about where they might fit in the cracks. So I've always tried to select whether it's works of creativity like Spooko, or I used to make rap music.
I know, yes,
or whether
Peach.
It's yes, Peach is your name. Yes. Look, we are a generation of Jameses, and so it had to be a riff on my surname. And like so whether it's a work of creativity like that, or whether it's a sort of business development sort of project like Coffee and a Case Note has sort of become, there's a question of wanting to do it in the most efficient way possible. And so the best tip I could make to someone trying to emulate balancing a full commercial practice with activities that include sort of online publication is that perfect is the enemy of good. And so if you're trying to push stuff out, if you are, for example, an ambitious law student running a very engaging podcast, just do good. Perfect. Yep. Perfect is going to stand in the way. There's always more audio tweaking you could come back and do, Alex. Right. And you'll always have your guest saying, more than you'd like. But getting to a point where you're really 80-20 about it, where you're really like, look, in an ideal world, that would have been utterly perfect. I'll get it on the next one. So that real I'll get it on the next one sort of approach is what I'd encourage anyone to adopt who's trying to do a number of things and keep all those balls in the air.
These time management priorities and strategies to make your time management more efficient are not things that come naturally to most people. I take it that it's probably not something that might come naturally to you. As a law student, were you a good time manager? And how did you build those skills?
I was fortunate in that I've been an 80-20 person through my life, or perhaps an 81-19, as some people who've had me give them feedback on some of their work or like their approaches to practice might think of me.
Yeah.
So I'll say I've been an 81-19 person through school and everything like that. And so that sort of gave me an experience where doing enough, like I understood doing enough through sort of exams and through schooling and through law school, and making the time to do that, getting my head around doing enough was a very important sort of way that I came to understand the way I learned. And I also understood that I was bad under immediate time pressure. I was never like a late night crammer oh my gosh, it's due tomorrow, I better start sort of person. So I'd always have the weight of anxiety descend on me, you know, the moment the assignment's assigned. I'm like, okay, it was assigned today. Great, it's due in 6 weeks. Okay, first draft should be done in 5 weeks. Okay, notes for the first draft should be done in 4 weeks. Okay, research should be done in 3 weeks. And so through writing, like, you know, honors, theses and this sort of thing, I was sort of very fortunate in that my mind sort of works in a way that it stages these things out. And I think that's more about self-knowledge. Some people might be good at sort of cramming the night before, and that's awesome. Love and blessings to anyone who takes that approach to life. But I just knew about me that I would have a very unhappy life if I was, you know, anxious about not having finished any number of things at any one time. So getting them planned out and getting them underway has been something that's benefited me over the years.
Well, I'm absolutely not a crammer, but I'm I'm also not an organizer. I'm not a person that uses a calendar. I'm not a person who, and yeah, it's much to my detriment probably, because I've noticed a lot of my friends at law school are starting to use their Apple calendars and it all looks beautiful.
Nice.
And I'm thinking, I haven't even opened my Apple calendar in years.
Lot of highlighters and post-it notes and that sort of thing sticking out of their textbooks.
I'm not one of those. I'm more so it's in the head, and if I forget about it, which quite often happens, I forget about it. But I think building those time management skills are definitely something that all law students have to eventually face.
Or come to understand that sort of time management is not your forte, and just sort of building ways to work around it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no one way to really succeed in this profession is the view I take. And so if you know about yourself that, Alex, you're never going to look at the lovely diary that someone might suggest you buy, or you're never going to glance at the calendar on the wall, I don't think there's a problem with that at all.
Right.
I think it's more about, look, you know, I've got this far using this method.
Yeah.
let's see how much further it can take me. Exactly. I think there's really something to that.
So as a law student, did you, firstly, what made you want to study law? So I understand your father was a lawyer, and you, am I correct in saying you come from a fairly long line of lawyers?
Yes, I think it's the term Nepo baby, Alex. Is the accurate description. So my dad's a lawyer, his dad was a lawyer, his dad was a lawyer. Okay. And so all I knew growing up was I never fucking want to do that.
Yeah.
And so even in final year of law school, I didn't go straight into law. I did arts commerce with sort of an economics sort of edge, and I did a lot of history there. I got okay marks in history and graduated from that about age 22, 23 and thought, oh, geez, I better do another degree that equips me for the workforce. And because I'd got okay marks there, I went on to do what was then called graduate law that I think is now called a Juris Doctor.
Okay, yeah.
And even in doing that, I was like, I'm never going to practice law, man. I'm going to be a pop music journalist or something along those lines.
Yeah.
But at each sort of decision point, I was like, well, having done the degree, I'll at least get admitted. And then, well, having been admitted, let's at least do 2 years of work and just see.
Yeah.
And having done 2 years of work, throw in family and a bit of lifestyle creep. There's sort of a forward momentum there, and that's sort of one ugly way of describing it. But a more genuine way for me is that because I didn't have a burning passion to do law as a young person, I was quite open-minded. I was like, oh, well, this seems a bit interesting. I'll just explore this area. And that's kind of allowed me to, over time, sort of actually really sort of fall in love with my area of practice, because I wasn't desperately burning captain of the debating team and, you know, from age eight, always in arguments and these sorts of things. It was very much the opposite, that despite the family background and perhaps as a very, very sort of teenage angsty reaction against the family background, oh, never going to do that.
Yeah.
It sort of gave me the space to say, oh, well, actually, let's see what this profession has to offer. And over time, it's turned out that, I might be somewhat well adapted to being able to enjoy a little bit of longevity in it. So a very slightly unconventional on one view, like how unconventional is it for someone with my background to become a lawyer at the end? But there was no certain thing in the middle, if that makes sense.
James, I would call you a Nepo grandbaby or Nepo great grandbaby. I don't think cuts it for you.
Those other Nepo babies better line up. Absolutely.
I saw a video that you posted, and you were discussing the hardest and easiest subjects, or maybe it was just the hardest subjects in law school. And you said one of the hardest for you was, I think, was federal constitutional law.
Mm.
You said you scored maybe 49. Is that yes. right? Am I getting that right?
Yes. So in an essay, yes. So hearing Al-Khateb sort of sends a bit of a shiver down my spine.
So there's obviously lots of trials and tribulations and ups and downs to law school. Being someone like you who had sort of studied a couple other degrees, weren't hell-bent on to getting into law, maybe taking sort of a challenge like that or a hitting a roadblock like that, getting a poor mark, might not have been as hard for you as it would have been for others who are really putting all in into law school. But what advice would you give to someone who has just maybe gotten a poor mark on an exam, which I know all law students at one stage have, and sort of picking yourself up and then being resilient enough to keep going?
I'm not qualified to give proper useful advice, because my advice tends to boil down to keep going or it's worth it.
That
you're kind of putting the trust in the decision you made in the past of like, well, I think what I want to do in my life is have this degree. And in order to do that, I got to keep going. Of course, a more sophisticated approach is, well, is this actually what I really want to be doing? And the view I take to that is having just failed an exam is not the right time to
make that
reflect
decision.
On. It's like, oh, having failed this exam, maybe I should give up.
Yeah.
I think those two thought processes ought to be pretty like quarantined from one another. And so if in your heart of hearts it is something that interests you and engages you, there's sort of crash or crash through sort of mentality that I'd encourage you to adopt, because you're so right, Alex, that all the sort of scary, formidable, besuited lawyers and everyone arguing in Alcateb and everyone in the High Court recently, they all had their disappointments. Everyone started off not knowing everything or not knowing anything, and it's a learning journey that everyone in practice has gone through, and it's only the most narrow-minded and sort of ignorant and cowardly practitioners, I think, that forget about those times when you didn't know everything in your practice area, and forget about those times when you failed too. And so you're actually going through a process that everyone who's in practice today went through. And so I think being kind to yourself and saying, yeah, all right, that's not the mark I was after, we'll get them on the next one, is very much the sort of approach I'd encourage anyone who's disappointed with their marks to adopt.
Right. And those disappointments, ups and downs, will follow you from law school well into your career. As you briefly talked about in your UNE, University of New England, Law Ball presentation, which I found very engaging and very interesting, you talked about your three biggest stuff-ups. I think you used a different word, but I'll use stuff-ups.
I think I've already sworn.
No, that's fine. That's
absolutely fine. I can withdraw it as well.
No, it's fine.
I described them as fuck-ups in the video, but I'm content for you to describe them however you would like.
So, yes, you talked about your three greatest stuff-ups in legal practice. And I think the reason that, firstly, that people like to hear about your stuff-ups are because everyone makes stuff-ups. And it's comforting to hear someone of your stature, James, that has also made a stuff-up. People sort of think they look up to older lawyers or more experienced lawyers who seem to know everything about what they're talking about, and they think, how could they ever make the return date on a subpoena the day that they're going to trial? But that's something you did, James.
How dare you, Alex?
So just talk me through, like, we mentioned resilience, and you said, well, just keep going. If it's something that you want, you just have to keep going. So just tell us a bit about how you pick yourself up in those situations, especially focusing on your first one. You mentioned three stuff-ups, but the first one, you were a junior lawyer, fresh into legal practice. And so when you make that mistake, it can be hard to pick yourself up because you don't know if you, well, really, do I have what it takes? I've really made a big stuff up here. How do you pick yourself up, especially as a junior lawyer?
Yes. You just keep going. Advice is seeming a little more glib now that we deal with it. You just keep going, including with the support of people around you.
Yeah.
And so what I tend to find is one of those stuff ups is when I was quite a senior and eminent lawyer, and it was a pretty serious stuff up and pretty dumb. And the support I immediately had was from fellow directors of the law firm I was then a director at. And it was profound, and it was immediate, and it was complete support. And then similarly, in 2009, the issue that you're exactly referring to, Alex, where some of our listeners will be familiar with subpoenas. That's essentially court order that requires you to produce some documents to the court. And this was a long-running case, and I was given the task of preparing a subpoena. And I thought the best date to get these documents that we needed was, of course, the same day as the first day of, you know, the final hearing of the whole matter. I thought, great, everyone's going to be at court. All these documents will be there right on the doorstep. They'll be able to use them. And, of course, there were voluminous documents. There were heaps of them. And it was more or less useless to have such voluminous documents there at court without weeks and weeks and possibly even months to consider the implications of what was in there. So choosing to have those documents returnable on the day of the hearing was a massive mistake. And look, how do you get through it? The next consequence was I didn't work at that firm much longer. And it was through the support of people I'd studied with. You know, some people think, you know, the network you build is sort of quite an ugly buzzword and makes you sound transactional about friendships and transactional about colleagues. Well, it's not that. Your network, if we use the word for it, is what will not merely sort of enable your success to sort of get work referrals and, you know, get the jobs and make the money and do all the deals and all that sort of thing. It's also, if you've been sort of authentic and genuine in the relationships you're building through your life, it's also a great support to you in those real times of trouble. And so I was able to speak to any number of junior lawyers who were facing any number of comparable situations who were able to be very empathetic to me, and they were people who I'd known for years because I'd gone to law school with them. And so that was a huge benefit to me. So that resilience point, sometimes it can be your own internal resilience of like gritting your teeth and keep going, but vastly more often it's about sort of the family you've got around you and the sort of the friends and networks and colleagues you've built, including at law school. So that sort of pick yourself up point is vastly easier if you've got a bunch of other people who are offering you a hand as well.
100%. And that is one of the great things about law school legal practice is the sort of brotherhood and sisterhood that comes out of it. You spend many years together in law school and then you become colleagues. So it's really great to build that network. So coming from a low point in your career, James, that early point, to a really high point now, you've just founded your own law firm. Tell us a little bit about Graveman. I understand you're going to be practicing in some pretty interesting niches of commercial litigation, corporate oppression, derivative actions. So firstly, just tell us a little bit about Graveman. Tell us why you're so interested in commercial litigation and why it's an area that you're passionate about and what you aim to do with Graveman.
Alex, I love a Dorothy Dixer and I'm really grateful. So Graveman, the name is sort of it. It's a word you might have heard before or might not have. I think it's a Latin derivation and it's a similar derivation to gravity. And it's a word that lawyers occasionally use to sort of refer to the central part of a dispute or the central part of a cause of action. So you might say, hey, the claim was for breach of contract, but the gravamen was that the lawn mowing services that James provided to Alex were really not up to standard.
Right.
So it sort of refers to the real focus of the issue. And so the message I'm trying to communicate, or I've got to start saying we now, don't I? The message we at Graveman are trying to communicate is that we, all of us, will band together and will assist clients in getting to the real heart of a matter without any extraneous mess around the edges. If I can just try to be as open and authentic as I can about what Graveman is, yes, it is a law firm, and yes, it is difficult to set one up, and yes, it is a bit of a career high point and I'm very proud. It also is just me and this four-year-old MacBook where, you know, running this meeting on and a mobile phone and my brain. A business name and an email address and just a couple of little other things. There's a humility point that the areas of practice we're in, we at Graveman, all of us here, it's just me, as I said earlier, we are looking to get into, tends to be engaged with by firms with a little more complexity, a little more experience, a little more people that we've got here at Graveman. So, My hope and plan is that Graveman's going to hang on to this humility. I'm here having watched the World Cup last night and having put on a load of washing before you and I hopped on the Zoom, Alex, is that Graveman can maintain this sort of humble beginnings sort of humility and approach to the world and can engage in reasonably complex commercial litigation that I'll come to for that other part of your question. So why commercial litigation in this area? There's this sort of truism in legal practice that your specialty comes to find you. And I think there's something to that. It just so happened the first law job I got of any real substance, was doing civil litigation work, was doing litigation other than crim, other than family. And that sort of edged into a bit of a mini specialty in what we sometimes call estate litigation or family provision claims, where people seek more money from the estates of people who've passed away or their notional estates. Then over time, that and a bit of work in building and construction sort of led to an understanding of partnership structures and companies and trusts and how these things worked. And over time, I just came to be very interested in the peculiar fiddly little issues that popped up in companies that were of this kind of small, medium size. Mm. And I developed some interest and a little bit of expertise in that area. Mm. And it then became a bit of a virtuous circle of, well, the more interested I was, the more I read about it. And the more I read about it, the better I got in it. Yeah. And the better I got in it, the better I executed my skills. And you sort of have this virtuous circle of the more you practice in the area, the more you learn about it, the more you enjoy it. So the more you read about it, so the more you enjoy it, so the more you learn about it, so the better, yeah, better your work is. And so over time, leaning into that area of interest, area of curiosity has been really valuable. And that'll be the heart of the work Gravenman does, as we currently understand Gravenman. Yeah. because it's just me and a laptop. We here at Gravenman will just be doing the work that I like to do.
Yes.
We'll see what the future holds. But for the moment, it's very much those areas.
That's great. It's so I take it, and this is the final question I'll ask you before I let you go, James. But I understand that approachability and rigor are your two key concepts to legal practice. And so I understand that you'll be applying those two concepts to your work at Gravenman. Rigor is
all very, of us here will. Yeah, that's right.
All of us, you and your laptop will both be working with approachability and rigor. So I can, it's quite clear why rigor is a key sort of point for a lawyer. But most people, when they think about lawyers, approachability is probably not, in just in the common understanding of a lawyer, is probably not one of the things that comes to mind. Tell us why approachability is important for you and why Gravenman will be able to essentially do better work because of your approachable nature.
That's the plan. Alex, approachability, I think, is a word I like that sort of describes the ability to get your message across sort of quickly and easily.
Yeah.
And so approachability, I say, is not merely smiling at someone and shaking their hand warmly and then remembering their name when you next see them, although those sorts of skills are very nice to have as well. Yeah. It is the ability that you can communicate to others and the ability for you to be able to listen and understand what is being said. So when I say that I want Gravenman's practice, all of Gravenman, including me, to practice in a way that is approachable, I want firstly for us to be good listeners, for us to understand, listeners and readers, to understand the material and the law that is in front of us, and then to be clear communicators, to be able to turn around sometimes quite complex concepts and make them understandable at the listener's ear. A lot of technical lawyers are really good at explaining things in a technical way. We here, and including me, want to be technically adept. We want to be rigorous, but we also want to be approachable and clear with the way we communicate, so that the fact it makes sense at my end might be one issue, but I need it to make sense at your end, anyone listening as well. And I say the strength of Gravenman will be its ability to combine that technical excellence or expertise with a nice approachability to it as well.
Yeah.
So that is the plan, and that's where I see approachability is valuable. And Alex, if you'll forgive me for boring you a moment longer, I also think it's an important point about advocacy as well.
Yeah.
One of the most valuable assets you have as a litigator is a judge's attention span.
Mm.
And if you are able to, in the shortest time possible, and the easiest way possible, convey a concept to the bench, then you'll have one of three things. You'll have a happy judge who has to spend less time speaking with you, or you'll have a judge who's got more attention span to share with you immediately after you've made your point, or you will have a point that has been made nice and clearly, or perhaps a combination of all three of those things. Right. And so your readers' and listeners' attention spans are the most valuable things you're going to have in legal practice, is my view.
Yeah.
And so to be as approachable as you can, I say, is a really important part of using those assets as effectively as you can.
And last thing I'll say, but I would say it's perhaps even a rare asset, because we hear a lot about legalese and how the law is unapproachable, it's cumbersome, and it's not easily understood by someone who doesn't have a background in it. So to have that approachability is maybe a rare asset, something that other solicitors or other practitioners may not be able to deliver as well as you can at Gravenman.
Well, that's the plan, Alex. That's hopefully the niche that Gravenman finds itself weaving into. As you kindly referred to earlier, I'm sort of 5 or 6 years into the project Coffee and a Case Note, where I try to summarize quite complex commercial decisions in a fairly approachable and straightforward way. And so I say that I and we have a fair bit of experience taking some pretty fiddly, complex scenarios and turning them into reasonably approachable bite-sized chunks that are nonetheless rigorous and complete in relation to the law and the facts.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, James. This has been a great chat. I'm sure our listeners will hopefully find a lot of value in it, as I have. We really appreciate your time, and we wish you absolutely the best with Gravenman. So all the best, James. Thank you very much.
Alex, it's been a complete delight. I'm very grateful personally, and you're very welcome. And everyone here at Gravenman is delighted as well. So thanks so much for having us.
Thank you very much, James.